From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artist bumper music for the first couple hours. Full details at our website, coasttocoastam.com. Later tonight, you're invited to the beginning of our 19th year anniversary party, special guests, and your open line calls. Here's what's happening. Well, the final stage in the selection of an American president comes at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, January 6th. Under the conditions of the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, both the House and Senate meet at 1 p.m. in a joint session of Congress in the House chamber. Vice President Mike Pence, in his capacity as President of the Senate, presides. But there have been several instances where the President pro tempore of the Senate, the most senior member of the majority party, will preside in place of the Vice President, and that would be, if it happens, Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican out of Iowa. For instance, President Richard Nixon defeated the Democratic nominee Vice President Hubert Humphrey in 1968. Humphrey was still the Vice President, but he was the and overseas for the funeral for the first United Nations Secretary General at the time. So it fell to Senator Richard Russell, a Democrat of Georgia. But we will see what happens Wednesday. This is a strange time, folks. National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger is doubling down on his theory that COVID-19 leaked from a Chinese government-run lab in Wuhan, as I reported back in December. Pottinger, a staunch critic of Beijing, made the claim in a recent Zoom meeting with British officials. The coronavirus death toll in the United States surpassed 350,000 early Sunday, as experts anticipate another surge in cases and fatalities stemming from Christmas and New Year's holiday gathering. But two top U.S. health officials disputed a claim by President Trump that federal data on COVID-19 cases and deaths in the United States is way overblown, and both expressed optimism that the pace of the vaccinations is picking up. Let's check in with Christian Wild from MyHeartBook.com for his weekly report on the COVID-19 situation. Christian, what do you have for us?
Well, George, the first thing we probably need to understand about this new variant strain out of the UK, it's B117. What we need to understand from the experts is this is not considered more deadly than the COVID-19 virus, but that it is more contagious, more easily transmitted. As an example, the World Health Organization has said 50% more easily spread and is already responsible for more than half of the new infections found in the UK, more than 53,000 new cases, George, in a single day.
Wow.
And what is alarmingly characteristic of this new strain compared to COVID-19 is that it is affecting people under age 20. Europe overall is witnessing an onslaught of B117 reported in 33 countries, as well as Australia, the Middle East, and South America. And the first three states in the United States reporting cases are Florida, Colorado, and California. The big question on many minds tonight, George, is going to be, will the two vaccines from Operation Warp Speed work against this new variant? Anthony Fauci said in his discussion with his infection control counterparts in the UK, they believe from the evaluations they have done so far that the vaccine will work against the new virus.
What do you think?
I think and hope that it does.
Are you going to take it?
Yes, I will take it.
Okay, I'm not. So you and I will compare notes.
Okay.
A couple weeks after you take it, Christian, all right?
All right.
Christian's website, myheartbook.com. Authorities around the world halted voyages on large passenger ships in March of 2020 after COVID-19 tore through the scores of vessels, but cruising really never stopped. Smaller cruise ships exempted from the suspension continued to sail selected routes to keep the deadly virus off ships. These boutique operators experimented with a variety of new precautions. They mostly failed. The coronavirus infections repeatedly pierced so-called safety bubbles, promoted by luxury cruise lines. Since June, about 200 people have tested positive for the virus on nearly two dozen cruises. At least one person, a crew member, died in his cabin with the virus. Let's check in with Captain Kelly Sweeney. Kelly, any updates on these cruise liners?
Ahoy, George. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on 19 years at the helm of Coast to Coast. I came on your show in 2006, and ever since then, I have enjoyed speaking with you about all the big maritime stories.
Thank you, Kelly.
Now, as we enter the new year, cruise ship companies are going to have to jump through a whole lot of hoops before they're allowed to continue cruising. I don't see that happening for 6 to 9 months, maybe longer. But the biggest maritime story I see right now is not in the cruises, but in the escalation of Russian military aggression in the Arctic. Late last year, in U.S. waters off of Alaska, the Russian military deployed 50 battleships, two nuclear submarines, and 40 warplanes on a fleet of civilian American-flagged commercial ships working in the Bering Sea. And they forcefully drove them from our exclusive economic zone off of Alaska. And all I can say on that, George, is, and I have friends who were up there at the time, this does not bode well for 2021.
Well, I got to ask you, Kelly, you know, as we look at these situations over the last year, a lot of these cruise lines, how are they going to stay in business, the big ones?
Well, George, the bottom line is cruises are a very easy vehicle to catch the coronavirus. As we've talked about before, you're stuck together with a whole lot of other people for 7 days at a time. You're sharing a buffet. I mean, there's so many ways you can pass on illnesses, and we've seen this for many years. And I know a guy who's an infection specialist with the CDC for cruise ships. We've seen this for years with the other viruses that have hit the noroviruses and other things that have hit the cruise ships regularly. This is just going another level. And like I said, these companies are going to have to jump through all the hoops that the CDC and other governments worldwide have put on restrictions before they can start cruising again. That's the bottom line. And like I said, I don't see that happening for 6 to 9 months and maybe a lot longer.
Okay, talk to you more in the year of 2021, Kelly. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, lucid dreaming is a dream where you know you're dreaming. It's a miraculous thing once you're into it. In a moment, we'll be talking with Andrew Holacek. His latest book is called The Lucid Dreaming Workbook. We're going to talk about lucid dreams in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Andrew Holacek, author of several books and scientific papers on lucid dreaming, including Dream Yoga, Dreams of Light, and his latest, The Lucid Dreaming Workbook. He's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, offers seminars internationally on lucid dreaming, dream yoga, and meditation, joining modern knowledge from the West with ancient wisdom from the East. His work is intended to wake us all up to our full human potential. Andrew, welcome to the program. Great book, by the way. Looking forward to this discussion with you.
Likewise, today. George. Thank you so much for saying that, and it's a total delight to spend some time with you. Looking forward to it.
How did you get involved in studying lucid dreaming specifically?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had quite an extraordinary experience. At this point, almost 45 years ago, I just finished a very challenging double degree. I'm a classical concert pianist, and I had a double degree in classical piano performance and biology. And I was thinking about going to med school, so I took it a year off to, you know, kind of get my ducks in order. And at that point, I was studying the very kind of nascent stages of, I guess you would call it, the New Age, the kind of channeling stuff and all the kind of psychic phenomena that I was into way, way back in those days. And I had quite an extraordinary experience, George, for about 2 weeks. I entered this kind of altered state, and actually retrospectively, I would consider that to be more the natural state. But in short, what defined it, George, was fairly constant lucid dreams at night. In other words, like you said in a short introduction, a lucid dream is when you wake up to the fact that you're dreaming and you're still in the dream. And so pretty much constant lucid dreams every night. And what was really fascinating was my daytime experience became increasingly dreamlike, increasingly illusory. And so it was a two-week mind-expanding, mind-bending experience that opened me up to new dimensions of mind an experience that I never knew were even available. And so that launched it, and then I started a rigorous kind of study of the great contemplative traditions and also physics. I came to the University of Colorado actually to study physics before I got my doctorate in dental surgery to kind of substantiate some of the experiences I had. So it was a long kind of circuitous route that led, really, if you can keep track of that flow chart, that led me to a very deep, extensive practice, study, exploration, both scientifically and philosophically, spiritually, of this amazing nocturnal mind.
Andrew, is there more of a comprehensive definition of lucid dreaming other than my real brief thing of knowing you're awake in the dream?
Yeah, you know, it's as straightforward as that. Sometimes what happens, George, is people get a little bit confused because they sometimes think a lucid dream is a clear dream. That's one obviously classic way to define lucidity. But in this case, it has a very specific definition. It's when you're in that, you're in a dream, and something triggers you into the fact, you know, that holy moly, this is a dream. And then the amazing thing is, instead of like waking up, like for instance in a nightmare, that often happens when we have a nightmare, right? Something clues us in, oh my God, this is just a really bad dream. And that's actually a moment of lucidity. And usually what happens, of course, is we kick right out of the dream. But with a classic lucid dream, you actually use that ignition, and then you stay awake in the dream. And it runs a bandwidth, George, from kind of barely lucid, you know, I think I'm awake in a dream. I kind of, sort of, mm-hmm. In some of these dreamlets that last, you know, 4, 5, even 6 seconds, all the way to the absolute game-changing, what are called hyper-lucid dreams, where you're in a dream state, George, that can last over an hour, that is so real, so vibrant, that when you wake up from one of those experiences and look around your room, for instance, that's what appears to be actually the dream. So those are almost like a near-death experience. They're so transformative because they point you to dimensions of experience that actually seem more real than the waking state.
I used to think, Andrew, that dreams were created kind of outside of the brain, but I don't think that way anymore, because too many dreams, for example, that I have been the result of little things that have happened during the week.
Absolutely.
And so I'm convinced that the brain has a lot to do with it, too.
Yeah, for sure. You know, that's one of the really marvelous things about the dream arena altogether. It runs a vast spectrum of dream itself. I mean, some of these dreams are literally just neurological noise. It's like you said, it's just a mere byproduct of brain function. And then it runs the gamut to dreams that really are no longer even part and parcel of your own dreaming mind. They actually become, you know, kind of more psychically predisposed. They open into dimensions of experience that are no longer just your own inner territory. And that's what makes this material just so incredibly fascinating, because there's such a tremendous spectrum of dreams, tremendous spectrum of applicability that ranges. And we can talk about it, because when I speak about what I playfully refer to now as the nocturnal meditations, lucid dreaming is just one of five meditations, five practices that you can do when you sleep and dream. And I'd be happy to ping through those if you'd
like.
Yeah,
go ahead. We've got some time.
Yeah. Well, again, this is my mapping of it. But again, I've explored this stuff exhaustively for decades. And so going from, you know, kind of more entry level to really kind of graduate school level, the first kind of nocturnal practice is, I like the new term, it's called liminal dreaming, liminal, which is the word literally means like threshold. The old kind of technical term was hypnagogic, which is also a very interesting term. Hypnos is the god of sleep. Gogia means leading towards. So it's that very interesting kind of plasma of mind when you're not quite awake, you're not quite asleep, you're drifting in and out. And most people really don't think of anything about that. Oh, it's just like this transit space between waking and the dreaming state. But that's actually a form of consciousness that you can explore. And I can come back to it and talk about what people can actually do in that dimension. Like, you know, some very interesting things you can explore with liminal dreaming. And so actually, of course, when that progresses and you start to enter, you go through the cascading of the four classic stages, into what's called REM sleep. That's mostly when we dream. Then of course, the first major nocturnal practice is, in fact, lucid dreaming. And the way I define that in contradistinction to, for instance, dream yoga, which is coming next, is that lucid dreaming is largely used for psychological purposes, for self-fulfillment. The things you can do there, George, it's unbelievable. You can rehearse things just like you do in normal life. You can...
Is it a protective mechanism, too?
Oh, for sure. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, the actual kind of biological, physiological aspects of dreaming are enormous. It's kind of sidebar here, but this is what I work with in my studies in the Academy of Sleep Medicine. In my clinical work, this is where you work with dreams in the integrative capacity. You know, dreams are where you take short-term memory that's temporally stored in the hippocampus, and, you know, that kind of gets uploaded into the cortex. And so that's where learning is integrated, that's where information is integrated, that's where connections are made. And in fact, you can do one of the, here's a very interesting sidebar here, one of the best things you can do to actually incorporate information is take naps. Because it's a wonderful way, in fact, to transfer those files from short-term categories into longer-term neocortex storage. And conversely, this is also a very interesting study. If you have traumatic experiences, one of the best things you can do is actually stay awake as long as you possibly can, because the sooner you go to sleep, the more those traumatic experiences will, in fact, be burned in the hard drive, so to speak. So that's a very interesting kind of converse discovery around that. But the physiological benefits of dreaming are extraordinary. We can talk quite a bit more about that. But, you know, in terms of just finishing the mapping, with some proficiency in lucid dreaming, then you can transition into what's called dream yoga. And that is where the practice becomes more spiritual than psychological. This is a great contribution, for instance, of Tibetan Buddhism and what's called Nandual Shaiva Tantra, which is a more advanced form of Hinduism. This is where the practice is not so much about self-fulfillment, like it was in lucid dreaming, but it's more about self-transcendence. And this is where you can do some amazing meditations and spiritual practices, and I can speak at tremendous length about what happens there. But in terms of finishing the mapping, there is, believe it or not, there's still two more stages. And these are, you know, I playfully refer to all these, George, as a kind of night school. You know, they really are literally a way to increase. I mean, we spend about 25% of our time in REM sleep.
Right.
That amounts to about a month a year. That amounts to about 6 years in the course of an average life. You can get a PhD in less than 6 years. And if you can maintain lucidity during that period of time, this is no exaggeration. Whatever you can do during the day, you can do in the dream state. And using the principles, I'm sure you've heard this term, very famous in neuroscience these days, it's called neuroplasticity, you know, that what you do with your mind changes your brain. You know, the scientists used to think that the brain was more kind of concretized. But it's actually plastic. It's malleable. You can change it. And countless studies have shown that what you do with your mind changes your brain. This happens in the dream state. What you do with a dreaming mind can change the physical brain. So that's where a lot of the benefits come from. But anyway, to finish the mapping, the kind of graduate school programs, the next one's called sleep yoga. And this one's pretty esoteric. It's connected to what's called yoga nidra in Hinduism. Nidra is a Sanskrit word which literally means sleep. And George, as unbelievable as it may seem, it's like, are you kidding me? This is where really advanced practitioners can literally maintain lucidity or awareness in the deep dreamless state. I mean, they're actually aware in the deep dreamless space. And there are now scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I am in dialogue with them, helping them construct design studies to prove it, because lucid dreaming has been proven since the 70s. But lucid sleep has not been scientifically proven yet, and scientists there are actually working on it. And this is where you do very advanced, very subtle types of practices and meditations in the deep dreamless state. And then the very last one is like postdoc. This is the most esoteric. This one's almost exclusive to the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And this is also a term that's getting a little bit more traffic these days, which is bardo, B-A-R-D-O.
All right, hold on, Andrew. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk more about that. And welcome back to Coast. Andrew Holacek with us. His latest book is called The Lucid Dreaming Workbook. We will take calls with Andrew next hour here on Coast to Coast. And if you're in the lucid dreaming, check in with us as well. Lots to talk with him about. Andrew, I'll let you finish up on that postdoc portion of dreaming. Yeah. Then I got some a few more questions.
Oh, absolutely.
For you.
Positively. Yeah, this will be brief on this last one. So the very last one is called bardo yoga. And bardo is a Tibetan word, literally means like gap, transitional process. And basically here, it simply refers to how you can use the sleeping and dreaming state literally as a way to prepare for death. You know, this is the deeper end of the pool, so we don't have to go here too far unless readers or listeners want to. But it's very interesting that even in Greek mythology, the Greek god of death is Thanatos. The Greek god of sleep is Hypnos, like I alluded to earlier, and they're not just brothers, they are twins. So there's a very intimate connection in philosophy, spirituality, religion, between death and dreams and sleep. And so that's the more advanced one, usually for the really deeper divers. So most people spend their time exploring, in fact, the dreaming state, lucid dreams. And so many ways we can take this, George. So let me know where you want to run with this.
Let me ask you about this. In terms of the various dreams that are out there, lucid dreaming, precognitive dreams,
right,
regular dreams, nightmares, which do you think is the most important, or are they all strong?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Here's, the really cool thing about the dreaming phenomena altogether is that they each has its own bandwidth of applicability. Two things here. One is that any dream can be used for the purposes of lucid dreaming. In other words, on that level, it doesn't matter. Even if it's just a neurological noise, just a hiccup of a dream state, any dream can be used for purposes of lucid dreaming. But within the dreams that you did talk about, probably the most transformative ones are these precognitive dreams. If you've ever had one,
oh yeah,
they're amazing. In fact, there's an absolutely haunting video you can watch on YouTube of a gentleman, a farmer, who had a series of dreams, precognitive dreams, day after day after day, absolutely predicting the American Airlines crash in Chicago that happened like 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so precognitive dreams, they're everywhere in the literature, and they're incredibly interesting.
That was David Booth, wasn't it?
Good memory.
Yep.
Good memory. Exactly.
I had him on as a guest a couple times.
No kidding.
That was at DC-10.
Exactly. I had two friends that were actually on that plane. And I lived in the area, so that was a big event for me.
It sure was.
But precognitive dreams, as you know, they're game changers, or they can be, because they actually start to question, like, what is really going on here? I mean, what does this tell us about the nature of reality and time? So the other one that you didn't mention that's really big, again, these fancy words for all these dreams, are what are called big dreams or theophantic dreams.
God, I wouldn't know that anyway.
Yeah. These are the great dreams that happen throughout history that can start religions, that can, you know, revolutionize philosophy, these really archetypal dreams that a little bit like I alluded to earlier with a near-death experience. If you have one of these things, and you don't need very many of them, just like you don't need to have a near-death experience over and over to change you, these are colossal dreams because they're so foundational. Have you had any experience with those yourself, George?
Yeah, I have a little bit. Most of my dreams are somewhat precognitive, or what I would call dreams to accomplish something. What would you call that kind of a dream? If let's say you got a job interview coming up on a Monday, and you go to bed Sunday night concentrating on that guy who's going to hire you.
Yeah, yeah. These are, you know, you can actually do that. It's actually a type of dream incubation, where you can do it either serendipitously, which happens just in the kind of spontaneous process that you're talking about, just because it's on your mind, you're really thinking about it, you're actually downloading that into your unconscious mind, and that's where dreams take place. So the really cool thing about these practices is they don't have to be accidental or serendipitous. You can cultivate these things. And this is what the great shamans and mystics do. It's actually part of their job description, so to speak. You know, they were literally incubate dreams for themselves, and even more compellingly, George, they can become what are called surrogate dreamers, where you can actually have a dream for another person. So let's say, you know, you're a gifted dreamer, and some people are talented in dreaming just like they are in music or other disciplines, and dreamers can become so adept in the dream arena that they can literally incubate dreams for other people. And again, the literature in all the indigenous traditions is full of stories about this sort of thing. And I've had several experiences from my own end around this, where I have, in fact, have had dreams for other people, and I share these dreams with them. Sometimes we work to interpret them. Usually the person can interpret them on their own. And in fact, they turn out to be either prophetic or precognitive, like you're talking about, or they can be highly kind of advisory. They can really guide people in terms of what to do.
So was it Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, who basically says we're living in a digital dream?
That's Elon Musk. Yeah, this is a transhumanistic simulation hypothesis. Yeah, and there's a lot of traction with that.
Whoever's dreaming us, don't wake up yet.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, that stuff is way out there, as you know, but, you know, maybe everything that we're experiencing in our entire universe is basically some kid in his bedroom dreaming up this simulation of what we know is our reality. I have some issues with that. I think it's very interesting.
The brat kid created COVID-19, huh?
Yeah, right.
My gosh.
So yeah, you know, that's a controversial topic. Obviously, there's a lot of people who don't really run with that one, and I'm agnostic about it. I haven't really studied it. It's open-ended question for me. I haven't studied it a great deal, but it sure is interesting, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah.
Can you train people to dream, especially certain kinds of dreams?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And you can do that a number of ways. You know, you can do it in the kind of classic dream incubation thing that I was alluding to earlier, which, by the way, this goes back thousands and thousands of years. You know, the Mesopotamians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Assyrians all had, in fact, in Greece, this is really interesting because we fundamentally live in the Greek intellectual legacy. And so in the healing temples of Asclepius was the Greek god of healing. So fascinating, George. What they would do is people would go into the temple, the healing temples of Asclepius. They would go through these ritual purification processes, fasting, meditation, all kinds of preparatory practices. And then they would have a dream directly from the divine physician, from the Greek god Asclepius. And then either they would interpret it or a dream interpreter in the temple would interpret it. So you can absolutely positively do it. In fact, the next book that I'm writing is tentatively called The Lost Temple of Sleep. It's based on that kind of archetype. But fundamentally, absolutely, you can incubate that way. And you can also kind of see dreams more specifically from the inside. And by this, what I mean is you can have lucid dreams where you're so aware in the dream, you know, borderline these hyperlucid dreams, you're so aware in the dream that you can start to work with dimensions of experience that are actually pretemporal, prespatial. This is where deja vu and the whole precognitive thing comes into play, because the farther down the rabbit hole you go, the mm-hmm. deeper you actually drop below the matrix of what we know as conventional reality. And this is where it gets extremely interesting and, you know, really mind-bending in terms of the potentials here. But, you know, we live in the Western world, as you know, George, it suffers from a type of myopia, nearsightedness, that anthropologists talk about as wake centricity. It's a kind of discrimination we don't even know we're afflicted by, which basically means in the Western world, the only viable way to know mind and reality and experience is through the waking state. Well, that's not the way it is in 90% of the other world's cultures. You know, Charles Laughlin, he's an anthropologist, estimates there are about 4,000 world cultures outside of European cultures. And he says 90% of those honor experiences from these other states, dreaming spaces, shamanic spaces. And so once you tap into these deeper dimensions of mind that are no longer limited to the surface kind of experiences, oh my gosh, the domain is a possibility is off the charts. And this is, George, is why I get so excited about it, because I think this really arguably could represent the education, the kind of pedagogy of the future. Once induction methods are harnessed and people can have lucid dreams with a little bit more constancy, and I have to say this is the great contribution of the West, then think about what you can do. Think literally, if you could add a month a year to your life, think of all the things that you could actually accomplish. It really is like adding a night shift or going to night school. So the possibilities, and if you want to go here, there's some very interesting neurological backing to this. This is not just kind of metaphysical mumbo jumbo. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of science behind this that really says that. In fact, just to give you one example, Matthew Walker, who's a hard-hitting neuroscientist out of UC Berkeley, he wrote a really wonderful book a couple years ago. You should have him on your show. His name, the book is called, you know, Why We Sleep, and it's a wonderful tour de force. And he only relegates 3 pages to lucid dreaming. And in those 3 pages, what he says at the very end is extremely interesting. He says, and this is a quote, "It is entirely possible that lucid dreamers represent the next iteration in Homo sapiens evolution." And there's a reason for it. And if you want to go there, we can talk about that. But this is one reason I get so excited about this stuff, is that once you gain access to these domains of your own mind, the things that you can do there are off the charts.
But only 3 pages? Check your book on lucid dreaming is 190.
I know. Go figure. But hey, just the fact that a hard-hitting scientist even talks about it is a big deal, because, you know, we have this dismissive relationship to the dreams in the Western world. Think about it. When we say, oh, it's just a dream, right? That's a dismissive comment. We think that dreams are just not as real as the waking state. And not according to the great wisdom traditions. They would argue that very forcefully, and say that those states, once you're lucid to them, are just as real as this waking state. Thoreau said this, Ramana Maharshi said this, many Western thinkers, you know, saints and sages going back thousands of years have all argued this. And so really, my riff on this, George, is we're literally lying on top of a vast, untapped natural resource of the unconscious mind. And these practices bring these unconscious processes into the light of consciousness, because sometimes they're called hybrid dreams, where it's a rare state. I'm trained in clinical hypnosis, and I use it with my clients. Outside of clinical hypnosis, of which around only 10% of the population is highly suggestible, this is the lucid dreaming state is a very unique hybrid state where the conscious mind can meet the unconscious mind directly and affect it. And so this is where the transformation comes from, because you're working with the roots of your experience. You know, if you change the roots, the branches, the limbs, the trunk, everything changes, because you're working with the foundations. And that is, in fact, one of the great benefits of doing this type of work.
Andrew, in your opinion, why do we need sleep? What is it that gets tired? Is it the brain? Something gets tired and makes you feel tired.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, adenosine. There's a chemical that is that builds up during the course of the day, and it's called adenosine. And it's a biological thing that literally builds up throughout the day. And actually, interesting what happens with caffeine. Caffeine just puts a temporary dam on it, and that's why when the caffeine wears off, you have the caffeine crash, right, where all of a sudden the adenosine that was blocked off comes crashing back in. And so Matthew Walker also has another neuroscientist. It's very interesting, and this is definitely worth throwing into the mix.
And just add this to it. What, sure. What wakes you up after you sleep?
Oh, well, first of all, the adenosine wears off. There's a kind of a homeostatic process that is equilibrated, and you find yourself simply coming out from a biochemical point of view, coming back up into the waking state. But fundamentally, you know, the neuroscientists have a lot to contribute here, and that's why I like to study both the East and the West, because I think they both have tremendous offerings. And, you know, honestly, for me, the burgeoning science, there's so much current study and science being done, not just on dreams altogether, but lucid dreaming. The work of Stephen LaBerge, Martin Dressler, there's Claire Johnson, there's so many really high-powered neuroscientists these days that are starting to do more and more studies on this stuff because they're starting to realize more and more of the potentials. And so you mentioned earlier, why do we sleep? Well, Matthew Walker says that on one level, sleep is actually, he argues, it could in fact be the foundational state, which is exactly what the world wisdom traditions say, and that in a very real way, we sleep because we have to repair all the damage that takes place during the course of our waking hours. And so it's obviously a restorative process, both from Eastern schools and Western schools. You know, things get a little bit out of whack. We need to go to sleep. I mean, think about it, George. When we get sick, what is the primary thing we do when we get sick?
You go to sleep.
You go to sleep. Exactly. And if you want to, again, like I mentioned earlier, you know, if you want to really have insights about things, what do we say? We don't say, oh, I'm going to eat on that. I'm going to run on that. No, we're going to say, I'm going to sleep on that.
Uh-huh.
And so
it works.
Absolutely, positively, when we get sick, it's because things are so out of whack that the body throws up these big red flares and it forces us to go to sleep, to re-equilibrate, you know, reestablish these homeostatic mechanisms. And basically that's where health comes from, a large part of it, you know. In Eastern schools, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, other Eastern schools of health, absolutely the same sort of thing. And their nomenclature, it's the elements, the winds, too much wind element, as they call it. We get too windy, too discursive, too speedy. And we lose too much of the earth element using that nomenclature.
Andrew, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back at the top of the hour and chat a little bit more about your work, the Lucid Dreaming Workbook, and we're going to take an hour of phone calls with you when we come back.